Until 11, local, national and international affairs. Plus some goss and scandal. You're listening to Mitchell's Front Page on 94.7 The Pulse.
And Monday Sport is ahead after 10:30. We'll be talking about the Geelong Football Club, their performance, as well as lots of other local sport with Mark Heenan from Mark Heenan Media. Also coming up before that, a look at some of the developments of first aid and some concerns from St John's Ambulance that not enough people in the community know first aid. But first of all, a bit of research from Deakin University looking at the correlation between socioeconomic status and consumption of sugary drinks. And with me on the line is Dr. Catherine Backholder from the Global Obesity Centre at Deakin University. Doctor, very good morning to you.
Good morning.
Can you just explain the research that's been undertaken, which is really looking at the correlation between sugary drink consumption and socioeconomic status of children?
Yeah, so this piece of research looked at approximately 3,000 children from birth through to 10 years of age. And what we looked at was the contribution of unhealthy foods and drinks contributing to socioeconomic inequalities and obesity by age 10. And what we found was that one of the key drivers was the consumption of sugary drinks from an early age.
And how young were we talking when it came to the consumption of sugary drinks?
So we saw high consumption of sugary drinks from the first year of life all the way through childhood, such that in the most disadvantaged groups, one in two children under the age of 1 year old were consuming sugary drinks on a regular basis, and approximately one in three for higher socioeconomic groups.
This is very, very interesting research. What was the methodology that you used to try and determine all of these different factors? I mean, you looked at BMI, how did you measure sugary drink consumption, and how did you measure socioeconomic status?
So socioeconomic status was a combination measure of things like income, education, where the family lives. So it was a combination of a number of different factors. BMI is a standardised measure commonly used throughout childhood that accounts for age and height and takes into account weight. And then the different types of foods we used, it was a cumulative amount of food consumption across childhood. So, for example, sugary drinks was all sugary drinks, so not just soft drink, but also, so in the early years, it's commonly more fruit juices, but that was also included as sugary drinks. And then we also looked at other discretionary food categories such as sweet biscuits and cakes, and then savoury discretionary foods, which are things like meat pies and chips. So, it was a cumulative intake across childhood.
Do you have any thoughts on why this has come about? Is it, for example, due to the costs of fresh food versus some of the items that you've just mentioned?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I think it's around availability. These types of foods and drinks are available everywhere, including settings where children commonly attend. It's to do with marketing. We know that these types of products are heavily marketed to children in particular, and also the price. So we know that these foods, these sort of ultra-processed foods, are a lot cheaper and a lot more convenient than fresh, healthy food.
How do you think we can change that pattern of consumption? How do you target people of a lower SES standing when it comes to things like advertising campaigns?
So I think we actually have to target everyone, because even though there were differences in the intake of these foods, it was high for all socioeconomic groups. So I think we need to target everyone, but we need to think of strategies where the most disadvantaged people are not left behind in our attempts to try and improve population weight and population diets. And so things like restricting the marketing of unhealthy foods to children would be a really good start.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is if you try and, for example, implement a sugar tax, if that's most going to be paid by people of a lower SES background or people of a lower income, that's going to raise a lot of concerns, isn't it, about who is actually paying the tax and subsidising. So it makes you question whether such a punitive measure could work and whether it is in fact fair to implement it. But then that seems to be the preferred policy solution from a lot of people out there.
Well, I think people advocate, certainly in the public health world, advocate something like a sugary drinks tax among other measures. And so the evidence does show that, yes, low-income consumers would pay a greater proportion of their income in tax, but the what they pay in tax is very small. It's less than, the difference between high and low-income groups would be less than $5 per year, so it's 10 cents a week. And the health benefits are much greater among lower income families and people because they're more responsive to the tax. And if you take into account their healthcare benefits over the long term, they by far offset any additional amount in tax paid for among low income families.
Do you have any thoughts on the advertising campaign approach, in that we've run so many advertising campaigns over the years? What sort of different approach could we use that would actually get some traction? I mean, is the advertising campaign approach that we've been using in the past actually working at trying to curb consumption of these drinks?
So I think there is a place for information-based campaigns, but we know the evidence shows that it will never be effective by itself. By simply telling people to change their behaviour, we know that it doesn't work, and we need to start thinking about the environment in which people make those behaviours. So personal choice is, of course, important. People still have to make their own decisions about what they eat, how much they eat, but we need to start thinking about the environment in which they make those decisions so that the healthy choice is the easier choice.
And how can it be made the easier choice? Does it come down to cost, or is it more that availability that you were talking about, where, you know, there's just such an abundance out there of sugary drinks, particularly at sporting venues and such? Do we just need to cut back on that and offer water instead?
I think we need to take a multi-pronged approach, so we can't focus on just one type of approach, because if we only focus on availability, there's so many other factors that influence healthy and unhealthy choices. So I think we need to think more broadly and more comprehensively, but certainly taking sugary drinks out of places like childcare settings and primary schools and sports settings are a good start.
The other thing I was interested is that you mentioned about the consumption of fruit juice. I think a lot of parents might give their children fruit juice thinking that it's healthier than, for example, Coca-Cola or other sweet drinks. But fruit juice has its own problems, doesn't it? And water is the beverage that should be encouraged.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at the Australian Dietary Guidelines, they recommend that children under the age of one do not consume any type of sugary drink at all, so it's just milk and water. And after the age of one, any kind of sugary drinks, including fruit juice, should only be consumed on a infrequent basis. So fruit juice, especially less than 100% fruit juice, has just as much sugar as a can of Coke.
Wow, that's amazing. When you say infrequent basis, how frequent is infrequent? Because to some parents, that would mean different things.
Yeah, so just as an occasional item, really. So I think it's unrealistic to say to cut it out of these kind of discretionary foods and drinks completely out of children's and anyone's lives, but they should be consumed on an occasional basis.
Yeah,
I think might be at birthday parties and things like that.
For sure. Well, thank you very much for being on the program this morning, and thanks for sharing that research with us. And we'll continue to watch what the developments are in this space.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Catherine Backholer, there joining us from the Global Obesity Centre at Deakin University.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye, Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.